540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A vehicle crashes and erupts into a ball of fire, killing two people inside and injuring a booth worker at Niagara Falls Rainbow Bridge border crossing. Witness Joe Cormillion.
Within seconds, everything was in flames. Thick smoke.
CBS's Linda Kenyon.
Seeking to, as she put it, dial down the temperature right now.
At this time, there is no indication of a terrorist attack.
Governor Hochul speaking at a news conference following the one-car crash at the Rainbow Bridge into Canada, saying it did cause a high level of anxiety on one of the busiest travel days of the year.
So naturally, in a time of heightened alert, everyone sprang into action.
And while the investigation could take days, Hochul said she could not emphasize enough.
At this time, there is no indication of a terrorist-involved attack.
Linda Kenyon, CBS News.
Just in time for one of the busiest shopping days of the year, a strike by more than 400 Macy's workers in Washington state. Their union says it's a three-day strike starting on Black Friday to protest what they allege are unfair labor practices. They're also demanding better pay. In the war between Israel and Hamas, no hostages will be freed until at least Friday. CBS's Holly Williams in Tel Aviv with the latest.
In Israel, the families of the hostages have endured anxiety and heartbreak for more than 6 weeks. But with hope on the horizon, a group of their supporters sang songs of peace in central Tel Aviv.
My life is end in the moment my family was broken.
Hadass Calderon's 16-year-old daughter, Sahar, and 12-year-old son, Erez, were taken hostage from kibbutz near Oz.
More than 50 million Americans will travel long distance for Thanksgiving. Good news for drivers. Gas prices this year are down compared to a year ago. CBS's Chris Van Cleve says you'll likely encounter a lot of other travelers this year.
The last-minute, not-so-fast Thanksgiving rush is on.
We got an early start this morning, so it hasn't been too bad yet.
Today will also be Amtrak's busiest leading up to Thanksgiving.
Train travel is more convenient. Prices were better than the flight.
And airports saw long lines on what's expected to be the second busiest day to fly of the holiday period.
Now, the holidays can be fun, but also stressful. The American Psychiatric Association says that one in four Americans worry about family time over the holidays. University of Rochester Clinical Psychology Associate Professor Ron Rogue says giving yourself some space is an option.
If it gets really toxic, then I give myself permission to remove myself from the situation. Like, go see what the kids are doing. Sometimes I'll just sit at the kid table because it's a lot more fun.
This is CBS News.
You don't need a job platform, you need a hiring partner. Indeed lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
This is Mean Gene Okerlund, and I'm talking with Brett Uhlberg, owner of Robert Half Diamonds. Brett, I hear you pay cash for gold.
Not only gold, but silver, diamonds in any form like jewelry, teeth, coins, flatware.
Why should I sell you my gold?
Why not? Our store is the only store that recommends you shop around before you sell. This way you know you're getting the most money. But if Robert Half Diamonds can't beat a competitor's offer on your scrap gold, we'll give you $20 just for letting us try.
Hey, what if I'm shy?
You? Well, at Robert Half Diamonds, we sit with you at a table. We go through your items and make you an offer. You're not pressured, and we offer more on jewelry that we can resell.
Can I trade my gold for a new piece of jewelry?
Of course you can, and not only that, we can custom make a piece of jewelry using your gold and gems.
Hey, there you have it, folks. Sell your gold to my friends at Robert Half Diamonds. Visit them on 76th and Layton in Greenfield. Robert Half Diamonds, where they want your business.
The journey to a smoke-free life can be difficult. Kick the habit with the help of Vape Walkie. Vape Walkie isn't just a vape shop. They're a community, and their knowledgeable staff can assist you in finding the perfect products to suit your needs. With a wide variety of vaping products at the best prices, they cater to everyone from novices to cloud enthusiasts. Mention this ad and join the rewards program to receive 100 free points when you sign up.
Vape Walkie, 215 Oakton Avenue, Suite C in Pewaukee.
Call 262-696-6620 or log on to vapewalkie.com to find more.
Work extremely hard.
College hoops, the Wisconsin Badgers in Florida. For the final round of the Fort Myers tip-off tournament, they take on SMU in the championship game. NFL, the Packers play the Lions tomorrow in the annual Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit. Kickoff 11:30 tomorrow morning at Ford Field. Matt LaFleur says that rookie tight end Luke Musgrave had to be hospitalized after suffering an abdominal injury against the Chargers. LaFleur telling the story when this happened.
Yeah, he's got a pretty significant injury. So, you know, I think it just speaks to his toughness because he didn't... Wow. That was interesting. Was that Taylor Swift?
It was.
Okay.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Partly cloudy tonight with a low of 29. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow, highs level off around 40. Tomorrow night, lows level off around 21. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 36 degrees.
Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us. Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and the Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. Thank goodness for our friends here at WCPT and the work that they do to help get the program on the air and give working people a voice, especially in this moment, as we're seeing organizing like no other time in my lifetime. Also here in Illinois, the push to make sure that workers have the right to organize, and here to share some thoughts on both this moment in history and, well, what the work being done here in Illinois. I've asked Carl Rosen to come to talk with us. He's the president of UE, ueunion.org, the website. Carl, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be with you again, Vic. Always happy to talk with you and communicate with your listeners.
So let's start with the moment that we're in. I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. The organizing that's going on, the level of excitement, especially among young people. We're seeing, you know, grad students, you know, saying we want to be treated better in the jobs that we do in universities. We're seeing nurses saying we want to be treated like the frontline heroes and the essential workers that we are. We're seeing Amazon workers. We're seeing Starbucks workers. We're seeing people finally saying, you know what, we've had enough, and I think it's about time.
It absolutely is, and you know, I think this is a reflection of the fact that the system is not working. And there's a whole generation now that, you know, the system has not worked for their entire adult lifetimes. Anybody who came into the workforce from the mid-2000s on has, you know, had just large swaths of trouble with one problem after another. And they're realizing nobody is going to fix this for them. The corporations aren't going to fix it for them. The government's not going to fix it for them. As workers, they're going to have to do it themselves. And the way you do that is through union organization. And that's what we're seeing. And, you know, right here in Chicago, UE just in the last 2 weeks has launched two very big new campaigns that are exact examples of this at the University of Chicago and at Northwestern University. Both of these places that graduate workers have announced they're organizing with UE, and in both cases on the first day they collected well over 1,000 cards of graduate workers who wanted to be part of our union, organize a democratic rank and file militant union that will stand up for their rights. They're self-organizing. I think that's the other thing that's going on, and you're seeing that whether it's Starbucks or Amazon, graduate workers, et cetera, this younger generation is taking things into their own hands. They're not waiting for established unions to come and do everything for them, some business agent coming in and pounding the desk on their behalf or something. They're organizing their own unions. They want to have their own autonomy. They want to have democracy. They want to have a voice at work, and they want it to be their own voice. And so they're doing it by organizing into independent unions, and we think it's a fabulous thing. And frankly, it's the way what most of us think of the labor movement was organized back in the 1930s with the CIO unions. It was bottom-up workers doing it themselves.
Yeah, my grandparents' generation, absolutely. And, you know, that whole business unionism of the 80s, that, no, it's just like car insurance. That has proven to be a failure. And I'm thrilled to see people taking control and taking back their unions and not making it one of the, well, that's the union's job. No, no, it's our job. It's working people's job to stand up and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunity, respect, dignity, all of those things.
That's correct. That's absolutely right. And it's very heartening to see. And I think it bodes well for the future. But boy, we've got quite the road to go through to get from here to there and a lot of organizing to do. And another reason, frankly, that is good, the workers are taking it into their own hands. There aren't enough staff in all of the unions in the country to organize on the scale that we need to. We need to be organizing tens of millions of workers into the union movement now, not waiting decades to get it done.
Now, what do you say to the people who say, you know, Liz Shuler took office as president of the national AFL-CIO and has this clarion call of a million new members over the next 10 years? She kind of took some abuse for that. Is that fair?
Well, you know, we're not in the AFL-CIO, my union, so we don't tend to, you know, comment publicly on what they announce one way or the other. But I certainly would say our union sees a need for a lot more than a million workers to get organized over the next 10 years. We'll not be doing much more than running in place to do that.
Yeah, I said from the beginning, I go, it's good to set a goal. How about you hit that in a year or two and then make another goal to do it again? That seems to be, and I know you need attainable goals, and let's hope that that's an attainable goal, especially in this moment that needs to be taken advantage of. So do you think we're doing enough? Do you think the labor movement is doing enough to encourage people to do this? Do you think this is just out of their control completely and young people are just going and just going?
Well, I think young people are going. And I think through projects like our emergency workplace organizing committee for the last year and a half, 2 years, we've been seeing that upswell all the time. Our joint project with DSA, where workers can call in and get advice on what they can do to start organizing at their workplaces. But I think a lot more needs to be being done by the existing labor movement to encourage us, to facilitate it, to give people the tools. But it involves some risk on the part of the unions that some unions, unfortunately, aren't willing to take because you're letting people have the keys to the car to a certain extent. When you tell them, go ahead and get yourself started organizing and figure out what your fight's going to be like, what your issues are, et cetera. Too many unions are used to kind of the security of having no small amount of top-down control and keeping things from getting too rambunctious, let us say. But that's unfortunately the attitude that's gotten us into the problems that we face today as a labor movement. Yeah. And so we're going to have to let some of that control go and let people run with it, but encourage them to do it and give them the resources they need and the support.
Yeah, especially coming out of this pandemic where, you know, workers, I do believe, have internalized that title we gave them as essential and frontline heroes and all of that stuff and patriotic. I mean, I hear that all the time when I talk to working people, that they took pride in that and they're not willing to give it up. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Carl Rosen. Carl's the president of UE, the United Electrical Workers Union. You can check out their website, ueunion.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Now, I come to Illinois, I come to Chicago. Chicago, basically for me, the labor history capital. I want to thank our good friend Larry Spivak and the Illinois Labor History Society for their help in putting our labor history in two together. Without them, it wouldn't be possible. People really love our labor history in two, so thank you, Larry, and the work that you do. But, you know, here in Illinois, you're moving this workers' rights amendment, which, you know, I got to tell you, I'm hoping people flock to, because we're in a moment where the anti-worker groups all across this country have been spending billions of dollars and organizing to take rights away from working people. I'm hoping here in Illinois that the voters in this state understand how important this is, put this in their constitution to ensure collective bargaining rights, and then maybe this is the springboard for the rest of the nation to follow the lead.
We would certainly hope so. We hope that that the example that Illinois will hopefully set on this come November 8th of putting worker rights into our state constitution will occur in a number of other states. There are a couple other states that already have somewhat similar language, although I think ours might be the strongest yet here in Illinois. It's not easy. The right wing forces, the corporate forces, frankly, are already on the warpath, looking to spend money to confuse people, to mislead people in order to get them to vote against their own interests, to vote against this referendum, vote on the amendment. But I think the labor movement's doing a pretty good job of getting the message out here. I know in our own union also, we've got materials we're getting out to our members to make sure that they don't bypass this question, that they vote on it and vote yes, and that we can get over the barriers needed to get this passed.
Yeah, but ultimately it's going to be more than just about union members saying that collective bargaining rights are important. Mm-hmm. I think about my aunt, who has never been a union member. She's about 20 years older than I am. But to her, the unions are so important for workplace democracy. The unions are so important for a voice in the job. Again, she's never been a member of a union, has never had an opportunity, has never been in an industry that was unionized, but she is one of the strongest union supporters that I know, because she understands what it means across the board and how she benefits from it. So I think that conversation has to be had as well, not just encouraging members to go, hey, protect what you have, but explaining to the broader public why it's important to have a strong, vibrant labor movement, why it's important to have workers who have good benefits and health security and retirement security and safety on the job and a reasonable wage, and how that benefits them and raises conditions for everyone. I think we got to do a little bit more of that as well.
Absolutely, there have been quite a bit of op-ed pieces and advertising on the media going on that the labor movement is making sure is happening in order to get that message out to the broader public. Absolutely, and then I'd also say I just heard you say we need to explain that unions are important for workplace democracy. I think the message is unions are important for democracy in our country. Period.
Right.
It's not just in the workplace; it's everywhere. There is no other mass organized offset to unchecked corporate power in this country. When you don't have a labor movement with numbers and a capacity to mobilize and resources, the corporate forces just take full control, which has happened in way too many states and to a large extent at the federal level also. And it's because our labor movement has been weakened so much ever since the McCarthy era, sent us on a bad spill in the wrong direction.
No, you're spot on right. It's important for democracy, not just workplace, but democracy as a whole. And again, I think this is why the wealth class is spending so much money trying to deny workers their rights, because I don't think they want empowered workers, because empowered workers become empowered citizens, and that's clearly not something that is in their interest, is it?
Right. That's exactly right, and you can see it very, very clearly that there's a whole swath of the power elite in this country that really want to not allow real democracy.
Now, I keep coming back to something that my grandfather said, and I've been saying this a lot the last couple of days, so I'm sure my listeners are losing their minds over this. But, my grandfather always used to say, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because he understands return on investment. And someone told me that the U-lines, the wealth class, the money
right.
interest have spent over $100 million on a campaign to stop this amendment that is already the law. It's not giving any more rights, or it's just making sure that what you have today stays for future generations, so your kids and grandchildren can have the same rights and benefits that you have today. That doesn't seem like a huge lift. It doesn't seem like way too much to ask for.
No, that's right. They have been spending millions. I think the $100 million figure has to do with what they've interceded in the governor's race at this point in order to elect extreme anti-worker candidates there, but they're also putting millions into directly trying to defeat the workers' rights amendment. So that's all the more reason we need to stand up, make our voices heard, and make sure people understand what the truth is and not what the lies are that they're spreading.
Then I got to come back to this return on investment. And someone, you know, showed me a newspaper. It looked like a newspaper. It's propaganda, but it looked like a newspaper just kind of being sent to people's homes, bashing this, saying that, and I don't know where they came up with this number that was going to raise your taxes by some obscene number, like, you know, like $2,900 or something a year. And I'd like to know which orifice they pulled that out of. But again, it's this kind of fear, smear, and well, lies that continue to be thrown out there that you know, it's almost like impossible to play whack-a-mole in this because there's so much distortion, so many lies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They have no shame. They make these things up out of whole cloth and then repeat them over and over. It's a big lie. It's what right-wing propagandists have done throughout history, and we had one in the White House just recently too.
Yeah. No, and this is why elections matter, and this is why come November 8th, hopefully people will get out, they will cast their ballot, they'll vote for the Workers' Rights Amendment, and we'll get worker-friendly, worker-centric candidates, working people into the halls of power to ensure that our rights are protected and we have opportunity for the future. Last question I've got for you, what's the message on this that you want people to know on this Workers' Rights Amendment? What's that elevator pitch for it?
This is about having an opportunity for working people to have a little bit more of an even playing field when they're having to take on corporate power and employers in general. It's important to make sure that we protect these rights in Illinois and have them going forward for generations to come.
Good stuff. Carl, I appreciate the time. As always, great talk with you. I hope you'll come back again and talk to us real soon. Good stuff.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And I hope to be back soon, too. Take care.
Good stuff. Carl Rosen, president of the United Electrical Workers Union. Going to take a quick break. Right back here from Chicago, WCPT 820. Here from their studios. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights took place in Washington, D.C. Estimates of marchers ranged from as few as 75,000 to as many as 200,000. The year of the march was significant. It marked the 10th anniversary of the police raid at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York's Greenwich Village. When police raided Stonewall, it sparked a series of protests that helped launch the modern LGBT rights movement. 10 years later, gay and lesbian Americans still faced significant employment and legal discrimination. Many also faced violence. The published program for the event included a tribute to Harvey Milk, the openly gay member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors who had been assassinated a year earlier. Lyrics to the song Harvey Milk's Body was written to the tune of John Brown's Body. The program also included an article urging march participants to lobby Capitol Hill for justice. A sample letter to Congress was printed as a template. It noted that many lesbian and gay men faced unjust discrimination in employment and called for change. The march organizers issued 5 demands. The second demand was that President Carter issue an order banning discrimination based on sexual orientation in the federal government, the military, and federally contracted private employment. The program included a list of organizations that supported the march. Not many labor unions endorsed, with a few notable exceptions, such as the Actors Equity Association, 3 AFSCME locals, and 1 American Federation of Teachers local. More demonstrations in Washington, D.C. followed. A march held in 1993 drew crowds estimated at 1 million, a powerful gathering for the movement to end LGBT discrimination.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I look at the Workers' Rights Amendment here in Illinois, and you know, talking with Carl,
Carl Rosen from UE. You know, the reality is his workers need to have that voice now more than any time in my working life. I'm not going to say now more than ever in the history of the country or work, but we're getting to the point. We're getting to a point where wealth inequality is so great. We're seeing stories coming out that we know. Look, we know that during the pandemic, you had the wealth class of this country line their pockets, you know, as they always do. Every time there's a crisis, never let a good crisis go to waste. Always an opportunity to cash in, line the pockets, and of course, you know, steal from those working people. Now, you remember during the pandemic, we were giving them extra couple hundred bucks in unemployment. We were giving them bonuses. We were giving them nice titles like hero and frontline hero and essential. We were saying nice things about them and giving them little drips and drabs. But now it's like, no, you're getting a little uppity now. And all of this inflation is your fault. And the reality is we know who caused the inflation. It was those greedy employers and those greedy companies who said, you know what, there's a good opportunity to cash in. There's an opportunity to line our pockets. And you know what we can do? We can blame those people. We can blame the workers. And of course, Joe Biden, because that's what the right does with everything. Everything is Joe Biden's fault. And look, there are things that are Joe Biden's fault. When it took me an hour and 45 minutes to get across Chicago, to go 18 miles to get to our event over at Rainbow Push, I blamed Joe Biden because there was a ton of construction. We're investing in infrastructure for the first time in a massive way, for the first time in decades. So, yeah, he gets some blame here, or credit, however you want to frame that. It's Joe Biden's fault that we're stuck in traffic because, you know what, he wants to invest in the country. And this is one of those moments where you go, voting matters. Our vote matters. Our time matters. Work matters. And I look at this workers' rights amendment in Illinois that is simply a no-brainer. It's the rights that they have right now. It's not adding anything. It's not enhancing anything. Look, there are some things I would like to see changed in our labor law. There are some streamlining that needs to happen to give workers the ability to exercise their rights in a much more expedient way, in a much better way, in a much faster way, in a much less harassing way. I would have added some of that in there. They didn't. They said, we simply want what we have. We want the law as it is, unchanged, for future generations. And the moneyed interests are spending like mad because they don't want workers to have rights. They don't want workers to organize. They want us to continue to fight each other over the things that they throw out at us, the outrage, because gas prices are going up. Curious. I saw one of the right-wing bloviators going on, you know, Joe Biden's trying to hold the, how did it go? Trying to blackmail the Saudis. Biden is blackmailing the Saudis. And one of the other commentators is going, you know, that sounds like a quid pro quo. We should be impeaching him for that. And you go, wait a second, did I miss something here? We got a president who's trying to lower gas prices because everyone agrees gas prices are too high. He's trying to do something about that for everybody. And yet that's a bridge too far. And then to compare it to Trump and the quid pro quo that really was. And you go, I think you're missing the big difference. The big difference is when Trump was doing the blackmail, when Trump was doing his scheme, when Trump was offering the quid pro quo, I'll give you something, you give me something. It was all about him. It was all about, I'll give you stuff from we the people, and you give me something specific. I want dirt on Hunter Biden. I want dirt on Joe Biden because it's gonna help me attack that guy. Biden's saying, look, I want to lower energy costs. Now, am I thrilled that we have to deal with the Saudis? No, I wish we'd be moving much faster on renewables. I wish we'd be moving much faster on getting us off the dirty stuff so we wouldn't have to rely on Saudi Arabia. We wouldn't have to rely on Russia and China. And that, you know, we could
son. But maybe that's a bridge too far. Maybe that's too difficult. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time.
The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Sources tell CBS News a male driver and his wife died when they crashed their Bentley near the U.S. side of Niagara Falls Rainbow Bridge this afternoon, and it went up in flames. U.S. Attorney Trini Ross says of today's border incident,
"We will continue to investigate, but our preliminary assessment of the situation is it was not terrorism related, but we will continue to stay vigilant."
A hostage exchange between Israel and Hamas won't take place until Friday, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, through an interpreter, says the war with Hamas is not over.
"We will continue eliminating Hamas in the north, by the way, and in the south. We will continue that effort until we have an absolute victory."
With millions traveling this Thanksgiving week, where you are and at what time can make a big difference. This man at Newark Airport hit it just right.
"We came in really early, anticipating that it's going to be a huge line, but it is pretty reasonable. Nice. It's good."
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
For Civic Media News, I'm Nate Wiggehout. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Governor Evers has pardoned another 82 people, mostly for low-level drug offenses or minor theft. Evers has now pardoned over 1,100 people in his time in office. That's significantly more pardons than any other governor in state history. About a third of those pardoned Wednesday were convicted of possessing or selling marijuana. Felons are eligible for a pardon 5 years after the end of their criminal sentence and cannot have any pending criminal charges or be registered sex offenders. Wisconsin officials are confirming the latest case of bird flu in the state. The Department of Agriculture says more than 51,000 chickens at a poultry farm in Trempealeau County were euthanized to contain the virus. 5 birds were infected in a backyard in Taylor County earlier this year. I'm Nate Wiggehout, Civic Media News.
There's excitement surrounding Carroll University basketball this year. Head coach Lindsey Schultz and the Pioneer women are fired up to deliver another winning season in the CCIW. You can catch all the action of every Carroll women's home game right here. Join Don Brown as he takes you from tip-off through all the game excitement on the Shaw, WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Partly cloudy tonight with a low of 29. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow, highs level off around 40. Tomorrow night, lows level off around 21. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 34 degrees.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
I'm not even clear from conflicting headlines whether or not Robin Voss has the cojones to move forward with impeachment against Meghan Wolf. Why would he do such a thing? You know, just a couple of weeks after he said he wasn't going to do such a thing. Well, he's been threatened, huh? By what? A group headed by his primary opponent, Adam Steed.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The fastest hour in radio, serving truth, justice, and equality with every slice. Outside the Pizza Box with Pizza Box Mike. Friday nights at 7 on the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK. Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Jim Hightower saying, hocus pocus, this is how the rich get richer.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Janice, listening on KTNF AM 950 in Minneapolis, sent an email Rick, love the show. It's been wonderful following along with the Working Class Heroes tour. I'm curious, what has been your favorite part of the tour? What's been your least favorite part of the tour? And that's an interesting question, because there have been some really great moments that I think are worth talking about and maybe going back to a little bit. I know my least favorite part of this whole tour is not being home. This is, you know, hands down, if that's part of the tour, but my least favorite, obviously, that. The favorite part, I got to tell you, the pizza in Chicago. But here to share some more thoughts on the least favorite parts of the tour so far, my producer and the professor, my good friend Brett Pransky. Brett, thanks for being here.
Hey, always happy to be here.
Enjoying the tour and spending a little time together. But again, the least favorite part, you agree with me, the not being home part?
Yeah, the not being home part is hard. We're, you know, this is the longest time I've ever been away from my family, my wife and my two kids. So yeah, that's probably the least favorite thing.
Yeah, I mean, now our wives, on the other hand, if we coming back when? Yeah. Now a favorite part. I immediately go to the I don't know, the pizza in Chicago was great. Favorite part so far?
Well, I would say that, you know, in terms of the different parts of the tour itself, when you separate the fact that, you know, that I'm away from home, I would say my favorite and least favorite moment are actually the same thing, and that was the coal mine tour in Scranton, because while the conditions down there, learning what working people had to go through at that time in that area, how they were exploited, just the absolute horrors that they had to live with every day, it was so deeply affecting that I'm grateful that I did it. And it's one of my favorite things in terms of what I learned. And also at the same time, just learning that was a thing, you know, is pretty horrifying.
Yeah. And I had done the tour before and again, it just solidified all the things that I've talked about over the years and the kind of anger, I guess, you know, outside of the pizza in Chicago, cause I love Chicago style pizza. I think the Greg Palast events have been, you know, in my view, because of the interaction, you know, the events, the places where we've had events, and we've had a number of places where we've got to meet folks. That to me, the interaction, the conversations that we've had with people, you know, people who, and this, maybe this is just me being with a bloated ego, but the fact that, you know, people come out just to say, hey, I wanted to come and meet you. I wanted to talk to you. I find that as a really good part of this.
Yeah. And I do too. I mean, we don't film the show in front of a live studio audience. There's not a whole lot of opportunity for that kind of feedback from people in real time. So when we get to get out in front of people and, you know, sit on panels and answer questions and, you know, kind of get that back and forth like we've been able to do at these Palast events, it's just it really does charge the battery.
And I got another email from a listener who was at the Chicago event at the Rainbow Push headquarters. Listener on AM 820 WCPT there in Chicago said it was great meeting you at Push. I 100% agree with your speech on the need for unity of working class. You talked about divisions and how the wealth class pits workers against one another. Can you go into more detail? Yes. I think we could talk about all the ways that we're divided, can't we?
Oh, certainly. All you really have to do is you know, is turn on your television and you know, and to find out, well, how are the moneyed interests on the right you know, slicing and dicing us today? You know, because when you think about it, well, it's why we talk about issues in terms of the working class. You know, we take those kind of left-right divisions, those red-blue divisions and so on, we take them, we turn them a quarter turn, all right? So now we're seeing them in terms of up and down. And this gives an opportunity for people to not only recognize all the different ways that they are sliced and diced, but it also gives them a chance to come together, stand shoulder to shoulder, and march in the same direction for the same things. Because again, these issues are so important to so many people, and they bring people together, because it doesn't matter if you're on the left or on the right or on any one, any, you know, any side of these divisions, you want a good life for your family. You want a good wage, you know, at your work. You want the opportunity to build a future for your children. These things are universal. and they bring people together, which is why we approach them the way we do.
Now, for those who weren't at the Push event, why weren't you there? But you know, I what I talked about is, you know, my experience growing up in a housing project as the minority in a minority community. And the reality is very young, I realized that white and black didn't matter as much as green. We were both broke, but we were supposed to be pitted against each other and supposed to be hating each other so that we didn't look to the people who had the green. And this is kind of the moment we're in again. All of these different divisions, all of these different ways of pitting us against each other is a way to keep us, you know, eating each other so that we never look up and see where the real problems are, which is the fact that we've got an economy built on cheating workers out of wages. We've got an economy built on you getting less health care and less retirement security. That's wrong. And until we can figure out how to heal those divides and those gaps, it's going to continue.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think one thing that we can do is kind of look to our history to ask ourselves, how did we do it in the past? For example, we were at the Rainbow Push headquarters the other day, and there's history all over the walls. History of the civil rights movement, just all over the walls, all over the entire place. And so, you know, what we can take from that is that, you know, at the time when these pictures were being taken, when this history was being made, many times the civil rights movement and the labor movement were attached at the hip. You know what I mean? They worked together. They worked in conjunction with each other. And it was always that way.
Yep.
And it should be again. So look to our history, we can repeat the successes of the past and, you know, make better lives for working people, you know, of all, you know, color, shape, sizes, you name it.
No, and that's something that is really important to understand, because it wasn't always that way. I mean, I go back, you know, to right after the end of slavery, and you know, a state like Tennessee, for instance, and their least convict programs, where they would arrest people for the most menial crimes. You were standing on the street corner too long, vagrancy, and they would lock you up, and then the state would basically sell you to a mine company. And you'd have a bunch of black workers going in, being forced into these mines in this lease convict program to break a strike. And it did two things. One, it broke the strike, but it also created that division, because the white miners who were out front of the mine striking and picketing would see these black miners being forced in and sent into the mines. They took our jobs, they're the enemy, when it wasn't either one of them. Where had they both stood together and said, no, the program's wrong, the program should be illegal, and the person administering it should be in the jail, and we should be working together to do that. Well, we didn't do that, did we?
No, we didn't. And I think what kind of what it shows us, in it's again, it's another parallel between the past and the present that we can draw, is that these issues are real. Issues of race are very real. Issues of gender are very real. But in many cases, I don't want to say all cases, but in very many cases, they are used to hide class. They are used to get people to care less about, you know, working class issues and divide us under all these other, you know, in all these other means.
Yeah, and I'm thinking back to when we did our civil rights tour back in 2015, and we went to the historic Stagville plantation, and the woman who gave us a fabulous tour, and if you're ever in Durham, North Carolina, highly suggest historic Stagville and take the tour of the plantation. But she walked us through the quarters of the slave quarters and through the working conditions and of course across on the other side of the fence where the white workers lived, and the divide there. And what I remember from that is she said, look, you know, the white workers had it much, much worse than the black workers did in living conditions, much worse housing, much worse food, much, much worse opportunities. But they thought they were better because they were told they're better because they're white. And that's always stuck with me, where had both working poor stuck together, maybe you wouldn't have had the suffering for both white and black workers. So for me, that's where this all comes from. We got to heal these divides. We don't have to like each other. We don't have to, you know, absolutely agree, but we have to figure out how we find common ground and move together in a way that makes everyone's life better. Or that's just my thought.
No, I agree. You know, the old saying, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. So if we can heal some of these divisions and create better lives, you know, for people in the workplace, then, you know, that will lead to, you know, better educational systems, which will in turn lead to, you know, a culture, a society that is much more accepting of difference than it currently is. So I think if we're able to create these situations, if we're able to create good lives for, you know, for people, for all people of all backgrounds, then some of these other conditions will start to heal. It's not the cure-all. It's not the silver bullet. It's not going to fix everything. It's not going to magically become better. But incrementally, these other concerns, these other issues will begin to diminish because we, as people and as working people, will get better collectively.
I'm right there with you. We're going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, I want to spend a little time on the Vigilante movie, talk a little bit about vote suppression, about some of the folks that we met at both the event at Rainbow Push in Chicago and at Crooners in Minneapolis. And thank you to both venues for putting on a fantastic event. We had an amazing time, and thanks to all the people at both locations who came out to say hello, to get active, to get engaged. We are looking forward to our next stop, which on the palace part of things, the Vigilante part of things, it's going to be Milwaukee on October 22nd. Email me if you want to attend. We'll make sure you get tickets. Make sure you get in the door and be able to see this movie.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. That was the day that the Executive Council of the American Federation of Labor decided to call for a boycott of Nazi Germany's goods and services. Jewish labor leaders in the United States led the push for the boycott. They were alarmed about the news coming from Germany since Adolf Hitler had taken over as chancellor that January. The day after the boycott decision, American Federation of Labor President William Green spoke with a reporter saying, "We found fresh justification for our action yesterday in today's announcement of Germany's withdrawal from the League of Nations and disarmament conference." In the months that followed the boycott, Jewish labor leaders continued to organize. In 1934, they formed the Jewish Labor Committee, a new organization headquartered in New York City. That year, the head of the Jewish Labor Committee, Baruch Charney Valedek, addressed the convention of the American Federation of Labor in San Francisco. He urged for more union action. In response, the American Federation of Labor founded the Labor Chest. The fund was established to aid in refugees fleeing Nazi persecution. It was also to support public education about the rising threat of fascism. In 1936, the AFL's chairman of the Labor Chest, Matthew Wall, declared that the events in Germany, quote, "concern us as deeply as the cause of labor, and that we shall spare no effort to help the victims of this regime." That same year, the Jewish Labor Committee organized a World Labor Athletic Carnival in New York City. The aim was to draw attention away from the Olympics that were being held in Nazi Germany. American Federation of Labor President William Green served as one of the honorary chairpersons for those games. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
So I want to spend a little time talking about the Vigilante, Georgia's vote suppression hitman movie, which I highly suggest taking a look at, especially if we can get to your neighborhood and you come out and see it. There's going to be a virtual, nationwide virtual showing at some point. We'll get information out on how you can participate in that. Also, go to gregpalace.com to check out his website and find out more about the movie. But I wanted to get some thoughts, and I've got the producer, the professor, my roadmate for the Working Class Heroes Tour here with me to share some thought. Brett, so what were your thoughts of the big movie?
Well, I mean, I found the movie really interesting for a number of reasons. You know, first of all, I consider myself someone who pays a fair amount of attention to these issues, and some of the things that were mentioned in the film made a little bit of national news, made a little bit of a splash. What the movie really gets into is it goes more in depth. I learned a lot. I didn't know that the issues went as deep as they did, and the movie really did a good job of uncovering a number of those things.
Yeah, it's there was a lot to it, but you know, what got me is, you know, the woman in the movie. There's a woman in this movie. She's like a county, you know, local Republican chair. She challenged 32,000 plus voters that she had no idea who they are. So for me, my mind keeps coming back to this. Explain to me why there's no repercussion for someone to do this. Why someone couldn't just go, you know what? I challenge every vote. Every voter is challenged. Nobody gets to vote. We shut the whole thing down. It seems like an ill-conceived idea from the start. I know why they did it, but it just seems like it seems really just badly designed.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. I mean, the idea, it's clear that these folks don't want to vote, and they want to open up every single avenue to keep them away from the polls. Keep in mind, this does a lot more than simply suppress the vote by removing voters from the polls. It's also incredibly intimidating. One thing that you learn about in the movie is the number of times that they actually, you know, they actually tried to arrest people for registering voters. And the number of ways that he would go about using the power of the state to depress the vote in very specific communities, who coincidentally happened to vote Democrat, you know, in a very high percentage. So it was really interesting just the lengths that he would go to suppress the vote.
Yeah, no, I kept coming back to, do you remember the group Acorn? For years ago, they were a group that, you know, worked in poverty-stricken communities and helped them do their taxes, helped them navigate, you know, government programs. Even, you know, I knew one woman who would take people grocery shopping. But one of the things they did is they did voter registration drives. And they would go into poor communities and they would register voters. And they became the target of the right wing for a while. These Acorn people, they're out there and they're registering illegal voters, or they're making up voters. And what had happened, if you remember, they had hired people to go out and register people to vote. And what some of these people were doing were just opening a phone book and writing names down so that they could get paid. The fraud was actually committed against Acorn. Well, what they did is they took these ballots, because what has to happen if someone brings in a ballot and says, this is a ballot, you have to put it in. You can't just rip it up. So they went to the places that do the voter registration, said, look, we think some of these are suspect. Seeing Mickey Mouse on a registration ballot, one would kind of think, you know, maybe some family didn't name their child Mickey Mouse. Maybe they weren't cruel and mean and ridiculous. So they went and they did this, and immediately they were attacked. You're registering people who don't exist. You're cheating the system. And the right-wing machine went after them until to the point where they ended up disbanding. And the right wing learned that lesson, that they can take those kind of organizations down. They can threaten, they can intimidate, they can do those things.
Right. Well, this kind of, you know, a myth of ballot stuffing and things like that, this isn't a new thing. It's been around a very long time. It's one of the things the movie does a pretty good job of drawing connections all the way back to that old movie, Birth of a Nation, which is, you know, an old movie that with some unbelievably horrific racist tropes, but one of them, you know, is of, you know, of people of color stuffing the ballot box. And this, as you notice on the right, whenever you hear the words voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud, and they keep talking about it over and over again, you know, they mean something pretty specific. They mean voter fraud in certain communities by certain people who they don't want to vote. And so they keep bringing this up over and over and over again in order to justify some of the legal means that they use just to scare people into not voting.
Yeah, but I go back to that woman. You're challenging, you know, 32,000 people's vote. I mean, there's a part of me that goes, all 32,000 people should be able to line up at her door. because there's got to be some repercussion. And as I understand, as Greg said, there's only one state where that happens. That's Florida. And I'm going, wow, Florida? Really? I'm struggling with that. But there's a moment where you go, there has to be some change here. And this is where having, I don't know, a federal government that gave a rat's behind. This is where, you know, having a Supreme Court that, I don't know, isn't trying to undo the entire Voting Rights Act. And maybe this is a moment where Biden has to step in and do something. Because I'll tell you, some of the frustration from people that we met at the Biden administration not doing more on the voting front, or as the one person told me, nothing, is a sense of anger and frustration.
Yeah, that's one thing that we heard a lot about in the panels after the film and things like that is a lot of frustration with the administration not taking enough action to kind of counteract some of these, you know, some of these things that are going on. So far, the only real repercussions that anyone has felt due to these challenges, and, you know, some of them being absolutely ridiculous, the only real repercussions have been, you know, Greg Palast knocking on your door and wanting to talk to you about it.
Yeah, and making you look stupid. And they did. The guy with the six-gun Doc Holliday wannabe guy, he looked every bit as stupid as he should have been.
He looked exactly how he deserved to look. You know, because he was ridiculous. I mean, he looked ridiculous because he was ridiculous. He looked ridiculous because he did unbelievably ridiculous, silly, un-American things. And it came back and it bit him. Not as hard as it should, you know, but at least it bit him a little bit anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is again one of those moments where, you know, Greg does an amazing job with presenting an issue and presenting it in a very entertaining way. And the movie was very entertaining. And he says, look, you know, it's a movie. You know, it is what it is. It was entertaining, but at the end of it, I still walked away angry. And I'll be honest, you know, as we were at the Push headquarters in Chicago, you know, all of the people who were there, understand the Chicago event at the Push headquarters, were mostly, you know, a large percentage of blacks, a number of whites, but, you know, the Minneapolis one, more whites, less, you know, fewer blacks. So the black people were like, yeah, this is reality. Why are you, almost to me, like, you know, why are you outraged? This is reality.
Yeah, I would say that between the two different audiences, one in Chicago, which was, you know, predominantly black, and the audience the next night in the Minneapolis area that was predominantly white, there was a significant amount of surprise, you know, greater surprise in the second room than the first. You know, and I think that's a good thing. You know what I mean? Because these are things that everyone needs to know about, because a lot of people, a lot of those folks we talked to in Minneapolis who are wonderful people, no one's come after their votes yet, but you better believe they're going to at some point. Yep. You know, it was a warning to those folks, and they seem to get the message that, you know what, this may not be happening to me specifically today, but, you know, I'm certainly on the menu for this kind of thing. And, you know, we better do something about it, because it'll probably be us next. They seem to really get that.
No, it's good to see the outrage, because maybe they understand how important the issue is. And maybe this is a way we heal. I mean, this is a way we maybe come back to some bit of sanity. And I hope there are folks on the right who see it and commit to voting and democracy. Look, even if I don't agree with you and I don't agree with who you vote for, I still want you to be able to vote. That's what this country has always been about, or at least my understanding of it.
Yeah, and actually, that's one thing that Greg said at both panels after the film, both locations. Is he doesn't care who you vote for. He doesn't care if you vote Democrat. Doesn't care if you vote. I'm sure he probably cares, but in his capacity as a reporter, it's meaningless to him.
Yep.
Because what he cares about is the vote. Period, and that everyone has equal access to it. How you use it is up to you, and, you know, and we may have our opinions on how you might be using that vote well or using that vote poorly, but that's not his intention in the film is not to get people to vote a certain way. It is simply to make sure everyone has access to the vote, period.
There you go. Let's finish up with the last question from Joe, who writes, how do I get a working class heroes t-shirt? That seems to be the question on everybody's mind, and we're working on trying to get something on the website so we can get people these fabulous union printed branded American-made T-shirts, so that, that folks can show their pride and their working class hero status.
Yeah, we've been getting a lot of questions about the shirts, and the one thing I can promise is this: there is a show store coming in some form. I will ensure it. A little hard to do from the back of an RV. But once the tour is over and probably, you know, just after election season passes, we'll make sure. Now, for those of us who are meeting us on the tour stops, we do have a truckload of them with us, and you're welcome to pick them up at an event.
There you go. Good stuff. Brett, appreciate the time. Looking forward to our next stop. Again, if you've missed any portion of the program, podcast. When you find out where we've been, where we're going, you can go to thericksmithshow.com and see that. Also, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
You've been listening to the Rick Smith Show. Email.
You're listening to the Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media?
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Preserve hometown radio.